This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Dylan Roof gets the death penalty and plans an appeal. News reports say Charlotte City Council considers reinstating its non-discrimination ordinance. At least two council members deny that report. Governor Cooper goes on the offensive, prepared to fight for Medicaid expansion and his own appointments. And new CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox inks his deal. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We are joined once again by WFAE's Tom Bullock. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Thanks for being back.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Eric Spanberg. You had to think about that for a second.
Do I want to be here?
And Eric Spanberg. He's the guy with the K at the end. Eric Spanberg is senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning.
Good morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. So I don't think it was a surprise that Dylan Roof, the man who killed nine African Americans at a Bible study at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, was sentenced to death, but he represented himself during the sentencing phase of the trial, and that rarely goes well. He does intend to appeal. Is that correct?
We can expect an appeal. He did ask the judge if he could. One of the few things he said in court after he found out that he would be the first person in U.S. history to be sentenced to death under a federal hate crime. Mm-hmm. He did say that he wanted a new trial and a new, to get new lawyers. The judge was really taken aback by that because let's not forget that Dylan Roof began the trial by saying he wanted to represent himself. And then he went back and had his lawyers. And then the judge did something a little unusual. For the sentencing phase of the trial, Dylan Roof decided he would represent himself again. Mm-hmm. But the judge allowed his defense team to be on standby, to basically sit next to him in court and pass, you know, suggestions. And, you know, you could see that actually. I was talking to a reporter who was covering the trial in Charleston, and she said you could see the lawyers handing over notes that Roof would read, and then sometimes he would write back, or sometimes he would throw them away. We don't know exactly what the legal advice they were giving him was, but he clearly did not take it because he barely said anything. He never the guilt of Dylan Roof was never in doubt. Within the first 6 minutes of his first interrogation, he confessed to the crime. This trial was really all about sentencing.
Yeah.
And you said that it was a preconceived, you know, everybody knew he'd be put to death. That's actually not necessarily true, because under federal law, the jury has to find unanimously that a death sentence is warranted for a death sentence to be imposed. And they did that in this case after just 3 hours of deliberations. But one of the reasons is when Dylan Roof spoke, he never asked the jury to spare him. And they cited that as part of their reasons. He has never shown remorse. In fact, during the closing arguments, he actually said he still felt like he had to do this. So the jury also cited the fact that he has no remorse. This was an intentional act. There's no doubt about premeditation. So the death sentence, barring a series of appeals, looks like it will be carried out.
And they've never brought in the issue, or he never wanted the issue of his mental competence
right. Or
health brought into it. And the jury didn't cite that, but I have to think that also factors into it.
Well, according to him, that was his entire reason for representing himself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He didn't want defense lawyers raising that as a possible defense.
But he presented no witnesses in the sentencing phase. He presented no evidence. He insisted that he was not mentally ill. He gave a rambling closing argument, the logic of which was sometimes difficult to follow. He showed no reaction at sentencing. Can any or all of this be used as a defense for a new trial? That obviously something is not right here, whether it's mental problems or ignorance of the law or a mistake he made in not letting his lawyers handle his case.
It's tough to argue that. I am clearly not a lawyer, but if you look at the clear material facts of this case, the judge gave Roof every opportunity mm-hmm. to have his lawyers take the lead to make sure that he had a competent defense. And he consistently turned them down. And let's not forget that this was after a series of psychological evaluations whose purpose was to find out if he was sane enough to stand trial. And under the Constitution, you have the right to defend yourself in court. You have the right to an attorney, but it's not mandated that you have one. So, you know, given the fact that Roof made a series of decisions all pointing towards the fact he wanted to represent himself in arguably the only real phase of the trial that mattered, sure, there always could be an appeal. There always could be a technicality. But on the grounds that you laid out, Mike, it's tough to see how that appeal would be.
The judge did an extremely good job of covering his bases in this case, not just the evaluation to see if he was competent to stand trial. There was a second one later on, right before the penalty phase, a second evaluation, and he told Roof on numerous occasions, "I think you're making a mistake."
Yeah, and I do have to say one thing too. You're absolutely right. He wasn't just fair to Roof, he was also fair to the victims' families. I mean, one of the more interesting things in the case is, again, during the sentencing phase, there were a series of family members who testified about the loss, their loved ones, what Roof had taken that Wednesday night. And at one point, Roof wanted a standing objection. He didn't want to have to interrupt the testimony of these people who are giving very painful testimony, but he wanted a standing objection, possibly, you know, for an appeal. It's a court procedural thing. It's, you know, there's a legal logic behind it. And the judge said, no, if you want to object to the testimony, you need to be brave enough basically to stand up and do it. And you need to give me a reason why, a specific reason why.
And that included, we should...
Right, that as unlikely as it is, it could have gone the other way. There could have been a holdout on the death penalty. And to me, that's the only emotion out of this is relief. There's no joy in this. This doesn't end racism. This doesn't heal the families or the community. But think how bad it would have been if one juror had said, no death penalty for this guy. And after all of that family testimony, that had happened.
His state death penalty trial was postponed indefinitely. Now that the federal government has sentenced him to death, will that trial eventually go forward?
Yes, it will. I mean, that's what the expectation is. They haven't rescheduled the date, but that is the expectation. And the reason why is actually pretty straightforward. It goes back to the core of your earlier question, appeals. South Carolina wants to try him as well. If they will seek the death penalty as well. It's almost a way to make sure that one way or another
he dies.
If the jury there finds,
I mean, if this did go into an appeal or something, this seems like one. What you hear over and over from everyone is, if ever there was something that warranted the death penalty, this is the case. I just think it's going to be very, very difficult to come up with a verdict other than the one that we've just heard.
Well, I've seen conflicting numbers on this, but Dylan Roof will either be the 60th or the 63rd person on federal death row. Federal death row sentences are extremely rare, and executions are even less common. So how long might it be before a death sentence is carried out, if it ever is, and which takes precedence, the federal death sentence or a death sentence that he may or may not get in the South Carolina trial?
There's no delicate way to say this. When you're talking about a death sentence, I think it matters on whose process takes the least amount of time. And I don't know enough about South Carolina's, judicial system to be able to say with authority whether or not it would be faster than with the federal case. But again, with the federal case, a big reason for the delays, I mean, first of all, there aren't that many people that are sentenced to death in a federal court.
Right.
I think they've only done, 32 or 33 executions since, the 1920s. And the people that you mentioned on federal death row are there because of the length and the legal process with appeals.
Timothy McVeigh was executed fairly quickly for the Oklahoma City bombing, but he wanted to die and he requested.
That's right.
Do we know how many of the federal death row people also have state death penalties against them? Is it common to have two death penalties or rare?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer to.
Well, didn't the federal government take up this case simply because South Carolina does not have a hate crimes law and they wanted to prosecute this under the hate crimes law?
It's tough to argue the motivation of federal prosecutors in this case. There are a myriad of reasons that this was a violation of federal law.
Right.
I'm not going to jump into the murky waters of just why, but the reality is, they clearly had a open and shut case. And let's not forget, too, that the federal government, specifically the FBI, were there right away. I mean, less than a day after Dylann Roof became a mass murderer, he sat down with FBI agents for the first interrogation.
Don't all death penalty cases, all people who are sentenced to death, don't they always get an automatic appeal?
Certainly on state levels. I'm not sure about the feds.
Yeah, I mean, again, it just goes back to the fact that the federal government does not sentence that many people. I shouldn't say the federal government. Federal juries do not sentence that many people to death.
So we don't know what the timetable for this could be. This could go on for years and years and years, or it could be pretty quick if South Carolina sentences him to death in that trial. The nation is split on the death penalty. Though Donald Trump and his nominee for Attorney General Jeff Sessions are proponents of it, recent polls show that less than half of Americans support it. And a poll taken in South Carolina, interestingly enough, reveals that most black people believe Dylann Roof should get life in prison, and most white people believe he should be sentenced to death. Is that based on race, on guilty conscience? What's that based on, do you think?
I think that's based on historical norms. African Americans in general are less supportive of the death penalty because records show that throughout our history, the death penalty has been applied disproportionately to African Americans.
And erroneously. In cases.
Many times. Okay, let's move on to, believe it or not, HB2 is in the news. It's always in the news. Mecklenburg County Commissioner Bill James posted on Facebook, I think this week, a memo allegedly written by Charlotte Chamber President Bob Morgan that indicated the Charlotte City Council might have been considering restoring the ordinance now that the HB2 repeal deal has fallen through. And that led to a report in the Charlotte Observer yesterday that said city leaders are mulling whether to reinstate the ordinance as a symbolic step. But yesterday on this program, I asked Councilwoman Julie Iselt and Councilman Ed Driggs about that, and they denied it. Here's Republican Ed Driggs.
I don't see it happening. I think our view right now is that the ball is in the General Assembly's court. Charlotte has done everything it can to take itself out of this conversation. I think the question came up as to what our next move should be. I mean, obviously, the deal that we thought we had wasn't completed. But the general consensus on council was that our best move right now was to kind of keep quiet and let the General Assembly figure out what it wants to do.
And I asked Democrat Julie Iselt if the city attorney had chimed in on this or whether the legislature has said it would be an illegal move. And she said no, because they aren't considering such a move. But the paper says the council has discussed this vote and are divided over the issue. So Ann, who's telling the truth here?
Well, I didn't write that story, so I don't have any firsthand knowledge. I do believe that if they quoted people as saying they were considering it, that there was talk about it. I mean, people talk and wrangle over things and speculate over what they ought to do. There was clearly political pressure for Charlotte to come back and make some kind of a stand. You know, they looked pretty bad. They completely rolled over for the state legislature, and then the state legislature punked them. So I'm sure they've talked about how they ought to respond. But it seems like going down this path is a reasonable response.
So when they say, there are two representatives yesterday, so council people yesterday said they have not discussed it, could it be that it's been discussed but not officially within the context of a city council meeting, therefore it hasn't been discussed?
Right. There's probably been a proposal introduced, nothing formal, but, you know, people discuss things all the time. Hey, what if we – and they may say, what if we, and everybody goes, bad idea.
Okay. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about this and move on to other things. It's Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Mecklenburg Library's Get Ready with Words, encouraging success in young children through vocabulary building. Parents and caregivers can teach a child words of the week at getreadywithwords.org. And Wilson Engineering Services now offering energy auditing, MEP design, and commissioning services to commercial and industrial clients in the Carolinas from their new Charlotte office. WilsonEngineeringServices.com. Well, the miracle on the Hudson worked its way back into the public consciousness with the Tom Hanks film Sully. It tells the story of a U.S. Airways flight that landed in the Hudson River with everybody on board surviving, many of them from Charlotte. On the 8-year anniversary anniversary of that remarkable landing, we hear the story of from some of the passengers who were on that Charlotte-bound flight in a conversation from the Carolinas Aviation Museum, an encore presentation of Charlotte Talks Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Obama bids farewell, Trump's fiery press conference, Rex Tillerson and key confirmation hearings. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer with the Charlotte Observer, Charlotte Business Journal,
excuse me,
and Doss Helms with the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Burke,
Wednesday's child,
editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com. We were talking about HB2 before the break, and the Business Journal reported this week that state tourism executives have learned some things since the passage of HB2. They're steering tourism ads away from news audiences. Eric, why?
Well, because the news is not very good when people bring up North Carolina. And, you know, they do a lot of regional advertising, obviously, you know, Virginia and Tennessee and the states that surround us. And traditionally, they have done a lot on morning news programs, for example. Hey, come to North Carolina. It's beautiful. And, of course, that is juxtaposed for the last year with this is the state of hate and people are leaving and nobody wants to be there. I'm exaggerating only slightly, but they don't like that pairing. And so the tourism group has decided to go more into what they call lifestyle programming. So The Walking Dead is preferable to your morning news program. And I'm really not exaggerating that. He mentioned that as one of the programs that they have advertised on through these cable deals. The other thing they have done is online advertising. They were often buying packages where they would have the ads paired with anything that related to North Carolina. So you couldn't pick the story, but if it was North Carolina related, you'd see this tourism ad. Well, obviously the shining mountains and so on, the coast did not gleam quite the same way when they were underneath the latest affections.
So maybe our new motto should be North Carolina better than the zombie apocalypse.
Right, exactly.
Just barely.
Well, speaking of the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, it's got a ring to it, doesn't it?
Speaking of that, this week, ACC Commissioner John Swofford said that the conference is likely to move its football championship game out of Charlotte again if HB2 remains in place. When will they make that decision?
March. The ACC has their next meeting in March. I talked to Councilman James Mitchell this week, was talking about how the city really is hoping that something will be discussed in the General Assembly by March. Dare we mention the R-word repeal? I don't know. But in March, there are a couple things coming up. The NCAA is going to award another round of future tournament sites, and we have the decision on the ACC football championship. And, oh, by the way, remember that decision from the NBA about moving the All-Star game from 2017 to 2019? Well, that is creeping upon us because you have all these long lead times. So time is of the essence, and that leaves the ball back in the General Assembly's court. So based on what happened a couple weeks ago, I think everything should be fine.
But there was an article in the paper today that gave a glimmer of hope that the legislature might take this up again at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I was up there Wednesday for the opening session, and Speaker Tim Moore said they have an appetite to discuss it again, or some legislators do, but he also said that the legislature would not betray its values. So while that is not specific, I think that probably indicates there still is a difference of opinion that might be hard to bridge.
And we've seen how many ways this can fall apart, yeah. So I think people are probably hesitant to get their hopes up too much.
So can we read into this ACC warning that they may take the game away again, that this is a stumbling block for a lot of organizations that is not going away until it goes away?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the NCAA and the ACC, that's going to continue. It will become a new rite of spring for us. Each year we can expect to hear that whatever was scheduled to be played in North Carolina will not be played in North Carolina.
Except that but at a certain point, I think it doesn't become a discussion. It's just, it's not North Carolina.
Right, because you know, you've run out.
It's not the default setting anymore.
Yeah. But I think until I think until some of this fallout starts to affect rural North Carolina, you're not going to see a lot of people in the General Assembly willing to.
But is that likely to happen?
Well, it could.
Because these big events don't come to rural North Carolina.
But the image does.
One of the things that's out there is this proposed boycott by the NAACP, which is a national boycott. I don't know how much that hurt South Carolina, but I can tell you, I know families who stopped vacationing in South Carolina because of that boycott. My family, we used to go to the beach every year at least once and maybe twice. We discovered the North Carolina mountains after the NAACP boycott was put mm-hmm. in place. So I think it could. Most of these events, I think you're right, they're not going to the rural areas, but you've got a lot of tourism out there.
Tom?
I think there's – I mean, Glenn, you're talking appropriately about the economic impact. I think the image impact is a bigger deal, and I think that's why you actually started seeing real motion on this. It didn't go anywhere, but we did start seeing real motion about this in a span over the summer where you saw the NCAA and the NBA and all these other things say, no, we're not coming. That is when all of a sudden, the Republican – state legislature started noticing things. They started giving. And if you actually follow the polls, and I know polls, there's a lot of conversation about the accuracy of polls. Don't think about specific numbers, but if you look at a trend, the polls seem to show now that a majority of North Carolinians believe that HB2 is hurting the state's image. They may not feel it in their pocketbooks, but they do feel it when they tell people where they live. So I'm beginning to think that if we do come to Eric Spanberg's new, rite of spring, as you described it, what you may find is if another round of these hit, that it's going to show the Republican lawmakers that this isn't going to go away, and it may get enough appetite for those people who did not want to vote for it, those Republicans specifically who did not want to vote for it, that they start seeing that maybe they can start whipping up the votes. But I honestly don't think – Phil Berger and Tim Moore, the top two state Republican leaders, they had huge black eyes out of this. They don't normally call these kinds of special sessions. They don't normally take these extraordinary steps unless they are confident that they have
right.
the votes.
They didn't. I think that's a really good point because – remember, that special session in late December, the House didn't even take a vote. And the reason they didn't take a vote is because the Speaker does not like to have a vote taken where the majority of his caucus is not supporting whatever the issue is. And so you saw that on the Senate side as well when they started with this cooling off period. And I think you also can hear it from Berger and Moore when they talk about Charlotte. They constantly bring up, well, we had a deal until Charlotte did X, Y, and Z. And that is a way of sort of shoving it aside from the problem they're having within their own caucus.
North Carolina is very aware that it's been losing competitions for manufacturing, big manufacturing mm-hmm. plants to South Carolina and some other southern states. I think the first time that North Carolina loses out on one of those, and it can be traced to HB2, I think you're going to see a lot of Republicans.
But haven't we already lost out on some of those?
Well, not because it hasn't been traced to HB2. We've lost out for other reasons. Which is why I said I think the first time we lose out on those and we can point to HB2 as a contributing factor, uh-huh. that then I think attitudes in Raleigh may begin to change.
And I think the flip side of this image thing, which actually could be a good thing in the long run, is that it has been in a lot of circles politically popular to demonize LGBT people. But when you have repeatedly athletic associations, corporate America, not these left-wing fringe groups, but very all-American people standing up and saying, no, we aren't scared of these people. We don't want them isolated. We want their rights protected. Maybe you start to see public opinion move a little bit on that.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump and congressional Republicans have pledged to repeal and replace Obamacare, although the replacement part of that seems a little iffy, almost instantly after Donald Trump takes the oath of office next Friday. But North Carolina's governor, Roy Cooper, is forging ahead with plans to remove one of the stumbling blocks that many people had in participating in the Affordable Care Act. That was the lack of the expansion of Medicaid to those people. He's working to expand it. Well, given the realities of the Republican-controlled legislature and what's about to happen in all likelihood in Washington, Why?
Well, I think, I mean, there are a couple reasons. One is the political statement. Obviously, you know, he wants to say, look, the way that the Republicans have been running the state is not the way the state should be run. He's also making the economic argument that, you know, you would add tens of thousands of jobs in rural communities, and you would improve the health of communities, and you would be getting federal money. And the last thing, Mike, before you pounce on me, the last thing is he's counting on at least several more years of the Affordable Care Act being in place. And so his theory is, why not get at least as much of the benefit as you can for a couple of years before a new system comes in?
But if it's going to become a moot point under Donald Trump.
But it won't be a moot point for several years.
How do we know?
Actually, Mike's right here. I have to correct you, Eric. We don't know yet.
Well, we don't know. But that's what he's counting on. I'm sorry. That's what Governor Cooper, I think,
Is he spending political capital, or is he banking it with his constituents?
Well, he's actually living up to a campaign promise. Take your view of Medicaid expansion out. He campaigned saying he was going to do this. Mm-hmm. The legislature wrote, you know, a law enacted by Governor McCrory.
Pretty ironclad.
Very ironclad, I have to say, that says no, and you can't do this. A governor can't do this without our okay.
And Robert Pittenger and Richard Hudson have both pointed that out.
Yeah, and they did this to a letter to the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Studies, which is the group, obviously, that is now looking over North Carolina's application to expand Medicaid. And there are two things to take care of. First of all, it may surprise some people that if this was a clean application – even though the Obama administration ends, they hand the keys over next Friday.
Right.
Even though this, we're talking about billions of dollars here, they could still be approved by CMS. So what the, you know, what is it, nine Congress people from North Carolina wrote a letter, as did State Senator Berger, to CMS saying, hey, this is against the law. We're urging you not to do this. Now, that'll be – I have no idea how CMS will rule on this. They may want to. They may not. I have no idea. But one thing that clouded this issue to me was actually something that Roy Cooper said – I believe this was Thursday – to the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners. And he said that he's looking forward to working with the Republican legislature to come up with a North Carolina-specific Medicaid expansion.
He did.
Now, to pass this – to get this through so quickly, he needs it to be a clean, we take the basic federal guideline that's out there, we'll do just that. So when he throws in this idea of a North Carolina specific, that could complicate things. And it may hold up, if that's what he's already done, it may in fact hold up the application.
The reason, one of the reasons, aside from the political opposition to Obamacare, that the North Carolina legislature decided not to expand Medicaid was because they didn't know what it was going to cost.
Right.
Because the federal government was going to subsidize it to a point, and there was a sunset
provision. 95%, right.
Yeah. But there was a sunset provision on that, and they didn't know beyond that sunset what it would cost them. So is this wise to do? Politics aside, if you don't know what it's going to cost and if Obamacare is going to be swept away and you're stuck with having expanded Medicaid.
Well, I think Eric's right. It's not going to be swept away immediately. We don't know that for a fact, but there is no way Republicans are going to be able to repeal and replace immediately. And I think by the time the sunset actually takes effect, mm-hmm. there probably will be some type of federal repeal.
But the trick is we still don't know. I'll bring up an example. A U.S. senator told All Things Considered yesterday that he wants to just do away with Obamacare, period, right away. And when it came to Medicaid expansion, he thought, you know, Medicaid is a wonderful program. However, there is no constitutional right to Medicaid. It should not be – there should be the first to go. Reporters I've talked to who have covered Obamacare since its inception think that the Medicaid expansion may very well be the first thing to go because Republicans love this idea of state of the federal money being in block grants. Basically, they divvy up a set amount of money and just give it to the states and tell the states, you run Medicaid however you like.
Now, and the other thing that's going on in this debate is Governor Cooper is seeking some political cover in his argument by saying that the hospitals would pay the 5% or eventually the 10%, assuming this ever went that long. So the argument he's making is, look, taxpayers in North Carolina are already paying into the system and not getting the benefit. Why not accept the money? I'm not saying he's right or wrong or that it'll work. I'm just saying that is the basic premise that he's starting with.
So Governor Cooper's working on that. He's also expanded his lawsuit against Republican leaders of the General Assembly, contending that laws passed during a special session limiting his powers are unconstitutional. And this is one of just several lawsuits in process. Where do all these things stand and what happens next?
They're in process, Mike. I mean, honestly, the first thing to watch, I'm not trying to be coy, we just don't know. The first thing to watch is what happens when, you know, the General Assembly convened this Wednesday. They're now off for 2 weeks. So when they come back, one of the things, and we don't know when they'll do this, but one of the things on their agenda will be to go through something that they enacted. And it's more complicated that they didn't change the law. It's actually in the state constitution. But they're going to use their right to, or at least what they see as their right, to confirm Roy Cooper's appointments to specific positions in his cabinet. Yeah. That's one of the things that is a lawsuit. So the next step is we watch and see what happens and when it happens.
And the question of special elections, I think, is a big one that one would think has to be resolved fairly soon if you're going to redraw districts and hold an election this
I'm
year.
I'm glad you brought that
yes.
up. Yes. Because voters are going to start feeling like they have whiplash here. The lower federal court ruled months ago that the current legislative districts are unconstitutional, racial gerrymander, and they ordered the General Assembly to draw new districts by March 15th and hold a rare off-year election in altered districts this November.
But let's just call it the Ides of March. Sorry.
Yes, beware. But now the U.S. Supreme Court has put that on hold. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because they're going to keep looking at it. They'll meet again next week. This will be just the justices. There's no oral arguments on this. And they'll consider it. The stay, you know, basically says, hang on, you don't have to do this quite yet. We may actually hear an actual opinion on this issue from the justices next
week. Thursday.
Yeah. But the trick is, it gets right back to what is, it seems you cannot talk about the United States Supreme Court these days without bringing up the number eight.
Eight, yes.
If, in fact, the justices do decide to talk amongst themselves and have a vote on this, if it ends up being a tied court again, then the lower court's ruling stands, which means the General Assembly will have to kick redistricting into high care and get right back on it. So we honestly don't know yet whether or not you know, we're going to have yet another round of state elections.
But Mike, here. I'm sure that you hear what I hear, which is that voters are hungering for more elections and campaigns. I mean, they really want
I miss
this,
attack so, ads yeah. so very much.
It's been ages. So
the 2016 campaign was just too short, wasn't it?
Have they done any legwork on the off chance that they might have to have an election this year and might have to have districts drawn by the 15th of March?
You've been in this business long enough to know that we're not going to know if they have or not.
Yeah, okay. All right. Speaking of laws and things like that, despite its troubles, Charlotte School of Law announced that it would be opening for the spring semester. And then almost immediately, within a nanosecond, it was revealed that the U.S. Department of Education was in discussions with the school about students getting an option to participate in what they call a teach-out. That's not good news.
No, that's not good news.
That's basically a going out of business sale approach. Yeah. It's how you transition. So students who are in their final semester can finish that final semester, and then you start phasing things out. And, this has been like watching a train derail, you know, one car after another. It's really hard to imagine how they could keep recruiting and keep going.
Well,
at
in
this
fact,
point.
And they're not recruiting.
Right.
They've actually already said we're not accepting, you know, the next round of students, which if you're a for-profit business and you say that you're cutting off your revenue stream for the immediate future.
That's not very good, is it, Tom?
I'm glad I could get the Business Journal view on that, Eric. Thank you.
Astute analysis. That's why I'm here.
I have one more question about this before we move on to the Andos Helm Show about CMS. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Baby and Company, a modern birth center offering individualized maternity and well woman care, classes, and wellness services in an intimate setting. More information available at babyandcompany.com. And Opera Carolina presenting Verdi's La Traviata, source material for Pretty Woman on January 22nd, 26th, and 28th. Tickets at 704-372-1000 or Opera Carolina.com. Justice.org. President Obama bids farewell. President-elect Trump has a fiery encounter with the press. Trump's cabinet choices face confirmation hearings. The weekly National News Roundup goes behind the week's headlines. Coming up on Point with Tom Ashbrook. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And we're coming right back with our local news roundup in just a moment. Stay with us.
Inauguration Day is right around the corner, and NPR will be here as a new administration takes office with complete coverage from Washington, D.C., and all across America.
Donald Trump is delivering on part of a campaign promise to stop an Indiana air conditioning factory from moving to Mexico.
Thousands of earth scientists are in San Francisco this week to talk climate change, volcanoes, and they are also talking about Donald Trump.
Listen every day.
Stay in touch with 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Our local news roundup continues with Glenn Birkins, editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Ann Dawes Helms, whose show this is about to become when we talk about CMS, because she's the only person that can talk about it. She's the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Before we move on, though, the Charlotte School of Law's woes. What is the significance of the fact that their top academic dean, Camille Davidson, who's the wife of Mecklenburg County Commissioner Trevor Fuller, was forced to resign last weekend? Should we read into that anything that has to do with their other woes?
Well, I think we just, if I can quote Tom, we just don't know.
Okay.
We don't know what that's fully about.
And this morning it is reported that Phil Dubois, who's the chancellor at UNC Charlotte, is probably going to use this as a stick to poke the dog with up in Raleigh when they meet, because he tried to have a law school established here, and then the recession hit, and that put the kibosh on those plans. With this would be the largest city in the country without a school of law, correct?
If this
goes out of business.
Right, and part of me just kind of thinks, so, you know, is a city hobbled by not having a school of law? But, you know, if there is a demand for it and if the supply goes away with the for-profit going out of business, then I could see where UNC Charlotte would be quite interested in stepping up.
But the trick there is the market for lawyers has not recovered significantly because of that recession. Still, you know, it's tough to be a recent graduate with a law degree and get a job right away in law. It's just not the same market that it used to be.
Well,
is whether or not the demand is still there.
He, in that interview in The Observer, he acknowledged, you know, some of the challenges that might go with it. You know, essentially what he was saying is, yes, we'll explore it. We would have to go, obviously, through the boards. And there is that issue of what is the need? What is the cost? Would this work? So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we'll have a UNCC School of Law.
Okay. CMS has been doing a lot of stuff in recent weeks. The new CMS superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, actually made an appearance here this week to sign his contract. And Ann, when you wrote a column about the unanimous approval of Wilcox to be superintendent, you started with a quote from Sarah Stevenson, who said she was feeling good about this one, meaning him. He has a nice smile, she said. Why did you choose to start with her in that quote? Just interesting to me.
Because this was finally a real person getting to meet him, and because sort of this face-to-face thing is part of the dynamic. And I do think at this point, it sort of feels like we're all sitting here with our phones out trying to decide based on a first impression whether to swipe right or swipe left. And that really isn't the issue here. This match has been made for us by 9 elected school board members and their search firm. So we do have him, but people do want to see him and get face to face. And the things he says are good things. You know, he talks about his strong respect and admiration for teachers and for the value of all honest labor. He talks about valuing diversity and every school should be a great school close to home. I mean, none of these things are, you know, none of the applicants probably disagreed with those stands. So to a certain extent, you come in and you say things, but people are looking at how you're saying them and whether you can back it up. He has interestingly talked about the fact that this will be his fourth superintendency. And he does say he's learned some lessons, that he's not quite as come in, tell everybody else how to do it as he used to be, which is interesting because I think we kind of saw that last time around with Heath Morrison, who was very early in his career, very confident, very much of a salesman, Clayton Wilcox kind of comes across, and I say this as a native Hoosier, he kind of has that Midwestern dad vibe. You know, he's you know, very sincere, very earnest, kind of tells some jokes that are a little bit corny. But, you know, what we're going to see is whether people feel like, yeah, I feel good about this
guy. He held his first news conference this week. The last time he was in town, he was the exclusive property of WBTV for some reason. But we couldn't get him either. Yeah. But
he was on their side.
Did you learn all that from that news conference?
To some extent.
You know, sorry, I just got that.
Wait for it.
Well, and the communications around this has been odd. You all talked about this on a previous panel. And even going into this, figuring out who had his schedule and who could get you on his schedule. And they actually, at the beginning of the news conference, Renee McCoy, the communications officer for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, came out and said, now, he's not going to talk in any depth about issues. We don't want you to ask about that. We want you to ask about his arrival and what he's looking forward to. And you can just kind of imagine the little thought balloons over all the reporters' heads with that. He seemed pretty willing to, and I do think it's reasonable to say he's not going to have a detailed discussion of what you should do at a specific school, but he seemed to reasonably well know the issues, although it's been interesting because in the previous versions of this, when the finalists came in, it was almost a contest to show how much you already knew about CMS issues and politics and context. And in this case, they're really kind of saying, don't ask him too many tough questions yet. He'll learn the answers.
I want to preface this next question by saying this is a complex, difficult, and thankless job. And the tenure in these jobs is relatively short, not only here but around the country. But he's going to make $320,000 a year up to that point, depending on his bonus, plus a $10,800 a year car allowance, $1,500 toward life insurance, and $15,000 in moving expenses. And he'll be paid $1,077 a day for any work that he does for the district before he arrives here in July. How does that stack up with previous superintendents and other people around the state in similar positions in terms of compensation?
I think it's kind of in that ballpark. You know, I think they have all, the last few, have been around $300,000. It's never all straight salary. The merit bonus is an interesting thing because for a while, again,
it's $280 in salary plus the 20% bonus
potential. Right, and a 10% bonus, I believe.
Okay, 10, yeah. Sorry.
Which is still significant money, $28,000. And that is sometimes very popular in that I guess they believe that it will encourage him to meet district goals, and it's often, you know.
Has anybody questioned why somebody making $320,000 a year needs a car allowance?
Well, it's the same thing with the city manager. These jobs, you know, it's a marketplace, and basically these standards are set in city after city, and you have these searches are routine, you know, national search, and so the search firms have the numbers, and they're all fairly in this ballpark, yeah, as you said.
Okay, so the school board and CMS under Ann Clark.
It's NPR money.
Have been working to redraw assignment boundaries to break up pockets of poverty. And Anne, you reported this week that during an update report on the plan, which was unanimously passed in 2016, fissures began to appear. Over what?
Well, and this is not the plan that was passed. The plan that was passed in 2016 had to do with magnet schools and option schools. And it was not easy, but it was the easy part. Because if you're looking at that, you can say, I'm not forced to change. I've got a bigger menu, and if I like it, I can order from it. And if I don't, I can stick with what I have. When you start doing boundaries, you know it's going to be really tense. But what was kind of odd is that they've been saying all along, and they've talked about, that we are going to go into this 2017, and we are going to have a whole lot going on. We're going to deal with boundaries, and we're going to get a new superintendent on board, and we're going to put out a bond package. And, oh, by the way, it's a school board election year. Yeah, we're good with that. And literally, Thelma Byers Bailey said during this discussion, I was one of the people pushing for this fast timeline. I now think it's a bad idea.
She, along with Ruby Jones and the board chair, Mary McCray, want to put the brakes on this. For how long and why? Just because it's moving too fast?
That's not 100% clear. This is somehow apparently linked to the fact that you had some West Side residents who showed up, and it should not be a surprise to anybody that they are frustrated by the condition of buildings there. Anytime you do a bond issue, you choose X number of projects, and the ones that fall right below that, people are really, really frustrated because the needs are there and they're going to be pushed way out. There's also the political frustration that comes from the way that they rapidly closed middle schools and created these K-8 schools, and they have really struggled. So what you see, which I think is really not a great sign for going into all of these changes, is the reemergence of some of these regional differences. You have people in, and this is roughly generalizing, but in the suburbs where schools are viewed as high-performing and high-functioning and people don't want change, they're kind of on the edge of their seats saying, you know, you told us you were going to resolve this and you need to resolve it in a way we're happy with. And you have people on the west side saying, you need to come back and look at this in a different way.
And some people on the board say that delaying this plan will undermine what officials have been telling the public for months and doom a 2017 bond vote.
It really is, I think, you're in trouble either way. If you charge ahead with this and again, this is roughly splitting along racial lines. So if you have some or all of the historical black communities throwing down the brakes, then the bond is going to be in trouble.
And they didn't see this coming a long time ago? They didn't consider this is going to happen a long time ago? Because we've always had these differences in region about how schools are perceived.
We have. And, you know, I think that they took a lot of satisfaction in getting to a point where they got something, which was the choice part of it. And, you know, there's always that, I'll deal with this next year. And
could
next
it be
year
that they
here.
Want Wilcox to make this decision and have the onus be on him?
There was a little bit of that subtext when you had some people saying, we agreed that Ann Clark was going to finish out this phase of it. And you could just, you know, Ann Clark is not an emotional, expressive person, but you could kind of see the shock in her face that they might be saying that everything you've gone out and told people for the last several months is not going to be true, and that the thing you thought was going to be the capstone of your career might just get put on hold until the new guy comes in.
And are we talking about $800 million or so? Is that what they want for the school bond? Or
very,
I mean, obviously
close to that,
has to go to the county commission.
You know, one of the things I think is worth pointing out here, too, what complicates this timeline even more is something that Ann brought up, which is this is an election year for the school board. So if I'm, you know, politicians are very simple. They like to get reelected in that sense. They're very simple. And school board members are inherently politicians. They are in elected offices. And having that around them, or uncertainty around them while they are campaigning, could really complicate their elections. Mm. Not to mention the fact that we don't know who will win. And when that happens, we could see everything they've been putting in place suddenly get shunted.
Right, reshuffled, yeah.
By the same divisions that Ann is describing.
And the really big question behind all of this is can they figure out some way to break up the concentrations of poverty without alienating a lot of other people and sending them fleeing to private schools or across county lines or to charter schools? And that, even if everybody was 100% on board, that's a really challenging task. And as they also pointed out, this ALVS group that they brought in as consultants, their contract ran out on December 31st. And some people are saying hallelujah because we didn't really trust that group anyway. But there was this discussion at Thursday's policy committee meeting of, do we have the expertise to do, again, what is potentially the even more complicated task of saying, how do we translate socioeconomic status to boundaries and decide where to move them?
Let's turn our attention south for a moment. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley moved up her State of the State address because next week she goes to Congress for hearings on her appointment to be Donald Trump's ambassador to the United Nations. What is her legacy in South Carolina?
That is a question. Even she said that it's up to history. And there is a lot to look at when it comes to Nikki Haley. You can look just at the person that Nikki Haley is. She is the first, not only the first female governor of South Carolina, she was also the first minority governor of South Carolina. You can look at jobs. I mean, I was looking at some numbers before I came in today, and during her basically farewell to South Carolina for now speech, she brought up 850,000 jobs, or sorry, 85,000 jobs. A $21.5 billion in capital investments in the state during her 6 years.
I think her legacy will be one of racial reconciliation as well.
She brought down the Confederate flag.
Yes, not just brought down the Confederate flag, but she was an incredibly uniting force after the church shooting. And I think she will be remembered for those two things as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. She has, I'm told that she was being considered for Secretary of State by Donald Trump, but she has no a foreign policy experience, and yet she's going to be
to send her to the UN.
So instead, let's get a corporate executive who has no.
So why did he choose her, do you think?
I don't know. I always thought that Governor Haley would be a terrific pick for Commerce Secretary.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me seemed the logical move. Believe me, I'm not going to try to figure out the motivations of how that wound up where it is. But I agree with Glenn in terms of the legacy, I think, is going to be about the racial reconciliation.
The possibility of Major League Soccer, I guess, reared its head last week. It's being pursued by Charlotte Motor Speedway president or owner Bruton Smith and his son. And the county commission met in closed session last week to consider a $50 million request because it would be a $150 million cost to convert Memorial Stadium, 50 from the city, 50 from the county, 50 from the Smiths. And County Manager Dina DiOrio, in her presentation about that to County Commission, remarked that it would be a good way to get people to ride the streetcar. But this week, a closed session of City Council to consider this was canceled. Why?
Well, because they don't like the fallout that immediately occurred after that meeting. I will say, partially in Dina DiOrio's defense, that's a little bit of cherry picking. That was one of the reasons listed.
Of about five or six.
But it is the most amusing.
Yeah, that's why I chose it.
So, so I'm with you on that. You know, the city is going to take this up because they have a January 31st deadline for the MLS, and they have to have a stadium site locked in. And Mike, basically this boils down to the same conversation we've had for 20 years, which is when it comes to sports, all rationality is thrown out the window.
Right. And Eastland Mall has that site, which the city already owns, has been brought up now as a place to put it.
But there's no way that the MLS or the Smiths would go for being the pioneers to redevelop Eastland Mall. They want to be right near downtown so that they can get as many millennials and others into their stadium as possible.
So what does this do to the minor league team, which eventually wanted to bring?
Yeah, they go away. You know, the Major League Soccer would have eminent domain rights, for lack of a better term, and so that the Independents would become an MLS team.
So this has to be done pretty quickly.
Yes, January 31st, and the MLS will make a decision in the third quarter of this year on the two cities that they're picking as expansion
sites. And given the fact that Charlotte City and Mecklenburg County haven't said anything, what's the chance?
I think it's pretty good that the city and county are ultimately going to approve this before the end of the month.
That's Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer with the Charlotte Business Journal. Glenn Berkins was here, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. And Doss Helms, education reporter with the Charlotte Observer. And Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.